Welcome to Broken Capitalism Lecture 4. We're trying it again. The last time I tried this, we had a call. Now watch the person call back. It works out that way. So as I was saying, as I wasn't saying, since I'm just starting the lecture, we have a theme that we're going to be talking about today in the lecture. We didn't have readings in this course from Human Action, but there's a theme that Mises discusses in the readings we had for this week that you'll find comes up in Human Action very much. It's a basic theme of the book. And if you understand this, then you'll find it much easier to understand Human Action. So this is particularly important. And the theme is this, that Mises distinguishes two different attitudes we can adopt toward the economy. These attitudes are attitudes in studying the economy rather than policy, although as we'll see, they're related to policy. One of these attitudes is that, say you have people in a political society like the United States or any country we want, people are in a certain political society, and the society has an economic system that we can talk about, the U.S. economy or the Egyptian economy or the Russian economy. So we have all these different economies. Now, one attitude some people take toward the economy is that it's up to the people in the society, the people acting politically, to run the economy as we decide. Sort of in the U.S., we'd say, well, it's up to the U.S. people to decide how we want to run the economy, what prices we want to charge, what wages, and so on. It's up to the people in the economy. And we can have this same view. We don't have to say that. Assume democracy, say we have a dictatorship, we say it's up to the dictator to decide what the prices and wages are, how the system will be organized, and so on. And in this view, it's really up to the people in the society or whoever is doing these decisions, to set these prices and wages in the way they want. They'll have certain goals they're trying to achieve, and really then it's up to them to decide how they want to achieve those goals. Now, when I say, according to this attitude, it's up to the people acting politically to run the economy, I'm not talking about the way, say, in a free market, we've been mentioning in the past lectures, it's really the consumers are running things because the consumers have preferences for different products, and then the business people are trying to satisfy those preferences. So you can really say it's the consumers that are running the economy. But that isn't what I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about a market in which the consumers are running the market. But what I'm talking about here is the notion that really the government can decide how to run the economy. It doesn't really have any limitations on what it can do. Say the government wants people to have higher wages, then it can just say, well, we want higher wages, or we think profit should be limited in a certain way. It's really up to the people who are running the political system, whether the mass of the people or the smaller elites, to really say how the economy should run, and that in this view, this is one of the two fundamental attitudes, they don't have any limitations on what they can do. It's up to them. And as you can imagine, this isn't the view that Mises holds. Now, the view, so if you say, well, it's up to the people, say, running the government, how to decide what price and wages should be, what should be produced, and so on. So in this view, well, they should be guided by whatever moral views they hold or what I think are political imperatives, for example. A lot of philosophers today think equality is desirable. If you look at the works of Marxist writer G.A. Cohen, who was a very good philosopher who died a couple of years ago, said, look, the market system is unjust because people are unequal. It's really people should be equal. So if you take the view that running the economy isn't really subject to limitations, then if you think equality is the desirable goal, then you should organize the economy so people will get equal incomes, just like, remember, some of you may know the great playwright George Bernard Shaw. He was a proponent of that view. He said everybody should earn the same amount of money. So see, what's involved here is that in this view, we're not talking about whether equality is a good goal or not such a good goal, but the view here is that you have certain goals, certain moral goals you're trying to achieve, and then you can set the economy so it'll achieve those. You're not really subject to limitations in what you can do. Another example, when I said political imperative, suppose you say, what we should do is build up the national strength of our economy so we'll be the most powerful country. Here again, it's a political imperative that's running things. You say, what we're aiming to do is build up military power, so we should run the economy on that basis. Again, I'm not talking now about whether that's a good or bad goal, but just the view is that if that's our goal, we don't really face any limitations in what we should do. Another example is there are some people who favor fair prices or living wage. They say, look, sometimes workers in the capitalist economy might not get enough money to support a family, and the employer ought to give them enough money so they can support a family. This was advocated, I mentioned, I think, in a previous lecture by Pope Leo XIII in his famous encyclical, which is a papal letter. Encyclical is a letter from the Pope that has authority saying what the teaching of the Church is. In the 1891 encyclical, Rerum Novarum, he called for a living wage. So the view here, again, I'm not concerned now on whether the living wage is a good or bad goal, but what I want to just point out is this view that's underlying that, it's really up to people running the political system to decide what the wages should be. It isn't that there's some limits that are fixing what the wages should be. It's really up to them. So if you think a living wage is a good idea, then you should enact a living wage. The view is you have a great deal of free play in running the economy. You're not really subject to limitations. Now, this view isn't very popular among economists. Economists are those who hold that there are limits to what you can do. You can't do anything you want running the economy. There are certain limits. But there have been economists who held this view. For example, there was a 19th century group that lasted through the early 20th century called the German Historical School. This is a group that Mises was especially opposed to. They included people like Adolf Wagner, Gustav Schmoller, and Werner Sombart. Mises is very much against this group. And what they said was, what in economics, there aren't really laws that apply universally. you might find certain regularities in various historical periods, but there aren't really universal economic laws. And what the economists should do is really just gather a great deal of historical data, say on prices and how the economy is operated in various periods. So some of these people in the German historical school were great historians. They were really good at amassing large amounts of data, but they didn't come up with very much in the way of economic conclusions. And Mises thought, well, a reason for that was they really favored this view that the state doesn't face any limitations or any important limitations in its economic policy. So if you believed, as the people in the German historical school did, that the Prussian state should build up national power, then it was free to do so. You couldn't say to the government, as free market economists would, look, you're going to get into a lot of trouble if you try to put in these regulations that you want to build up the military strength of the government. Some of these will have very bad consequences for the economy. The people in the German historical school, like Wagner and Schmoller, said, no, that's not right. The economy isn't subject to laws in a way that limits what the political system can do. Another group were the so-called American institutionalists. Institutionalist doesn't mean they came from a mental institution. It was just they were called institutionalists because they studied economic institutions. And people in that group included Wesley Clair Mitchell, who was the founder of the National Bureau of Economic Research, Thorstein Veblen, famous one, you may have heard of his famous phrase, conspicuous consumption. Veblen was an institutionalist. John R. Commons at the University of Wisconsin, these were all institutionalists. So they tended to deny there were economic laws. And I see Malcolm said, isn't this view that this still common among the general population? Yes, that's an excellent point. You're very right. You do find people think, well, if we want, say, higher wages, we should have it. We saw, for example, Pope Francis said recently, well, the business people in certain countries are very unfair. They should pay better wages to people. So I think he's assuming it's really up to the government or up to people in general to really set prices in whatever way they can. If there's a moral imperative that we ought to have prices of such and such a kind, or we ought to have equality, then nothing, or virtually nothing, stands in the way of their doing that. Now, Mises doesn't accept this view. This is, remember, the view is that really the government or the society in general can really set prices and wages the way they want. If we have certain moral goals, well, then that's up to us to put them into effect. Nothing is really standing in the way. So Mises said, no, that's not true, that economic phenomena are governed by law. And he draws an analogy with the physical world, where in physical world we can't do what we want. We have to respect limits that are disclosed by the laws of physics. For example, imagine I'm at the top of the Empire State Building in New York, and I say, well, be nice just to fly around New York and to see the sights. If I jump off, I'm not going to be flying around. I'll fall fall very rapidly down to the earth and be killed. There's a law of gravity that will be operating. There's limits on what I can do. I'll say, but that example reminds me of a story which a man woke up in the hospital and he was all bandaged up, and then there was a friend who was visiting and he said, "What happened?" And the friend said, "Don't you remember at the party last night? You got drunk and you bet everybody you could fly out the window on the third floor and then fly around the block and come back in again." And said, "I did that." And the friend said, "Yes, you were completely drunk." And he said, "Well, why didn't you stop me?" And the friend said, "Stop you? I had $50 that said you could do it." Well, I thought it was funny anyway, but regardless of whether that's funny or not, we know in the physical world there are certain, actually Travis laughs at my joke, good for him. So we know there are certain limits on the way matter behaves, that you can't say, "Well, I'd like the world to be a certain way," but you have to respect the laws of physics. So Mises thinks it's one of the greatest discoveries of the human mind that economic matters are also governed by law. So it's not just a physics, matter in motion, that's governed by laws. Human action is also governed by laws. There are laws of human action as well as physics. And it wasn't obvious to people who already knew about physical law. There were laws of economics, because economic laws are discovered in a different way, not by observing matter in motion and coming up with theories about how matter will move and then testing those to see whether they're right. But economic laws are discovered by thinking about the concept of action, what's involved in it. So it's a very different process from the process used to arrive at physical law. But nevertheless, it comes up with real laws that limit what we can do in the economy. So the view that I've been sketching in the first part of the lecture, that some people say, look, we have certain goals that we want, say, we want equality, we want military power, then it's up to us to set prices and wages so that we get those goals. We don't have any limits on what we can do. We just have, here's the goals, here's how then we set the price and wages to achieve them. That isn't, according to Mises, the correct view, that there are limits to what we can do, just like the physical limits on what we can do in the world. We can't. If you walk into the street in front of a moving car, you're not going to like what happens to you very much. There are certain laws of physics and laws of physiology that will operate in a way that you're not going to like very much if you do that. You know, I should mention, of course, Mises wasn't the first economist to write on this thing, that there's people, and of course, economists have been aware of economic laws long before Mises wrote, but what I mean here is the explicit comparison of economic laws with laws of the sciences, taking the view that just as scientific laws of the physical world limit what we can do, economic laws limit what we can do also. What I'm talking about is this specific analogy. And Mises wasn't the first to come up with this. In fact, Mises' teacher, Eugen von Bombaver, gave a classic account of economic law in his essay, Control or Economic Law. And I've given a link. You can read that. It's one of the classic statements. It's taking view. Look, in the economic system, we can't do whatever we want. We have to respect the limits of imposed by economic laws, just as we do in the physical world. Now, we've been talking about economic laws. Well, what's an example? One would be a law of supply and demand. This law would say, as the price of something goes down, the quantity demanded increases and the quantity supply decreases. I see, assuming people's preferences don't change, if price goes down, then you'll want more, at least not less, because at the lower price, you can have money left over to buy other things as well. So you can afford more. You'll be able to afford more of the particular good. You won't have to give up as much of other goods to get what you want. But at the same time, when quantity supply, when price goes down, the quantity supply will decrease, or at least not increase, because the people who are supplying the good won't be getting as much for it. They won't be offered. If you're not offering them as much, they're not going to be as eager to sell to you at the lower price. We can see this is very commonsensical law of supply and demand. Everybody knows it, but the thing to realize here, this is a law in the way, same way that we talk about law of gravity. It limits what people can do. Just as law of gravity, you can't jump and move about whenever, however you want, but you're subject to your certain limitations based on your body's interaction with other bodies in the physical world. Similarly, you can't set prices however you want and then sell or buy any quantities you want. There are laws that govern price and quantity, the effects of what will happen, the effects of quantity if you change the price, and effects on price if you change the quantity. So we can imagine prices for a particular good, say, let's say we're talking about this lecture series. Suppose we set the price at very, very low price, that we didn't charge anything at all. Then there'll be more people want to buy than there are sellers willing to sell. Maybe that wasn't a good example, because I don't get paid actually according to how many people buy my lecture. But supposing I was paid according to the number of people who buy my lecture program at one time. I mean, I was, and supposing it was a zero price, then there might be a lot of people who wanted to listen to the lecture, but I wouldn't be so eager to supply the lecture series at a zero price. And they actually had examples of that. You know, in this class we haven't gotten too many students. I've had in classes that we charged for. I've had I think around 200 students. The ones that were the most popular. We had about 200 students. I think my logic class got that, has gotten that. But a couple times I've given free lectures, and those get about 500 students sometimes. So you see, when at some prices, at very low prices, zero price, there are more people, a lot of people who want to buy. Now, supposing, say, I charge $5,000 for this lecture series, well, I'd be very eager to give the series at that price, but it's extremely likely nobody would buy it. So at some prices, there are more sellers than buyers. People other price. Oh, Jeff said he would have. Well, that's very kind of you, Jeff. You're welcome to send me the difference. Just make the check direct out to me. And that's very kind of you. But well, I'll tell you, I have a story on that. I have a lot of stories. There was a man who was a beggar who had was selling pencils. And he's saying, someone said to him, how much are the, for a pencil? He says, $5,000. So the person said, well, you're not very likely to sell many at that price. And he said, all I need to do is sell just one of them. So, okay, so we have, this is very much common sense, there's some low prices, there'll be a lot of buyers, very high prices, a lot of sellers. Now, there'll be one price at which everyone who wants to buy at that price can do so, and everyone who wants to sell at that price can do so. And this is what's meant by law of supply and demand, the law of one price. We can figure this out, why this is right, because at a lower price, there'll be more people want to buy than there are sellers. At the higher price, there'll be more sellers and buyers. So then we can get a price at which there'll be an equal number of buyers and sellers. Now, Kevin says, that got a large enrollment. Yeah, I don't know why people like that course. It was, I taught that twice. That was, that one did tend to get a lot of people. Now, I want to raise an objection to what I've said. I'm sure this objection will have occurred to a lot of you, even if you hadn't looked ahead in the lecture slides and seen what it was. Okay, what's the objection? What I said was, according to Mises, you can draw an analogy between economic laws and physical laws. So people who think, like the members of the German historical school, that really you can set prices any way you want, just if you have, say, certain moral or political goals, you can set the prices any way you want, are wrong, just as in the physical world we can't jump off a building and fly around because there are physical laws that limit what we can do. Similarly, in economics, there are laws that limit what we can do. So this view that we really have a lot of freedom of action to regulate the economy politically is mistaken. So what's the objection is that physical laws don't always hold. You can't violate the law of gravity. Supposing the legislature passes a law saying you can't drive if you drink, if your blood alcohol content is more than a certain amount, you can't, you're forbidden to drive. Well, you could violate that. Somebody could drive while drunk, a lot of people do, but you can't violate the law of gravity. A law of scientific law is a statement of a universal regularity, it's not something that's telling you what you can and can't do. You know, the story of a drunk driver who was stopped and the policeman gave him a blood test. And he said, we found a little blood in your alcohol. Okay, so, Arthur says economics is concerned with goals, physics is not. If that's a very good point you raise, Arthur, but question here is, and this objection is dealing with this, does the fact that economics concern the goals, does it follow from that there aren't laws of economics in the sense there are laws of physics? So the objection is, well, I said, you can't violate the law of gravity, but can't people violate economic laws? I said, there's a law of supply and demand that says that there's a certain price that will clear the market in the sense they're more at that price. Anyone who wants to buy at that price will be able to do so, and anyone who wants to sell at that price will be able to do so, whereas other prices will have either more buyers than sellers, more sellers than buyers. So supposing we say, okay, there's this economic law that says here's what the price, what the law is that will give you this price that balances supply and demand. But people can charge other prices in the market, clearing prices sometimes do. We'll be talking later in the lecture. We talked a lot in previous lectures about price control, minimum wage laws, and so on. Well, those are certainly prices that are not in accord with the price that the law of supply and demand would determine, but people, they certainly are prices that people have established. So in the case then, this objection says economic so-called laws aren't like physical laws, because the physical law is invariable. If two particles attract each other gravitationally, well, there's a fixed law that will say what that gravitational attraction is. You can't change it. It isn't something like you can give the particles a ticket or put them in jail if they don't attract each other in the gravitationally correct way. But people can violate economic laws. So this objection would say, isn't it wrong then to say that economic laws really are laws in the way scientific laws are laws? But this objection, I guess, given that economic laws aren't really laws because people can violate them, this objection isn't correct. Even if government sets prices, it's still true that the economic data establish a particular price, the market clearing price. So the government could say the price in effect is some other price, but the economic law would say this particular price in this situation is the market clearing one, the price that will balance supply and demand so that anyone who wants to buy at that price can do so, and anyone who wants to sell at that price can do so. That isn't something that's subject to the will of the political system. So in that sense, contrary to this objection, which the objection was, well, you can violate an economic law, but you can't violate a physical law, it's not right, because economic law can't be violated either. It's just like a physical law in that sense. People can't change what the market clearing price is given the particular economic data in a situation. So even though the government can set a different price, it can't change what the market clearing price is. Now, Mises makes another related quite significant point in this connection is, suppose the government does set a different price from the market clearing price, then this will have consequences the government doesn't like from their own point of view. So he's saying, well, look, if you ignore the economic law and just say, well, I want the price to be something else, you can try that, but you're not going to like what happens. It's similar to the example I gave about jumping off the Empire State Building. You're free. If you jump, the law of gravity will still be in effect, and you're not going to like what happens. So you're not, if you jump thinking that you can just fly around as you wish, you're going to find you can't, and you'll have, from your point of view, bad consequences for you. So similarly, if you think you can set prices whatever way you want and won't have it affect the quantity supplied or demanded in particular ways, you'll find that you don't get what you want. So the economic law does operate just like the physical law. It sets certain limits. Now, Malcolm asked the question, would you say there are always unintended consequences when charging above or low market price, and this goes for even voluntary producers, not just state setting price? Yes, that's a good question. Yes, certainly we could imagine, say, a business charging a particular price. Say that, and this happens all the time, say the business person thinks that, says, well, I want to sell my good, I'm going to charge such and such a price, and he finds that at that price he isn't selling very many, so he'll have to lower his price if he wants to make money. So the fact that the transaction is voluntary, it doesn't follow from that that people know what the market clearing price is, and they're going to have to find that out. That's what bargaining is for. And if they try to insist on, say, charging a higher price than the market clearing price, they're free to do that, but then they're going to find it has bad consequences. So the fact that it's voluntary doesn't change the analysis. But that was a very good question to ask. Now, we talked a lot, we've talked about a particular example of economic law that we've already said something about and also discussed in previous lectures, but we'll go into a little more detail in the time remaining. This is price control. Now, there are two kinds of price control. One is setting a minimum price. It says you can't sell below this price. Well, this is supposed to benefit the sellers because it's saying you're going to get at least this much for your what you're selling. Minimum wage law would be an example of that. That would say if you're working, say the minimum wage law, what is it now? It's $12 an hour, $10 an hour. So this is supposed to benefit the workers because then if you those who favor that, they say, well, look, if you go to work, then you're going to be sure you get at least that amount of money. You won't be getting less than that, so that would help you. And so is that's what the theory of it is. And the other type, price control, is setting a maximum price that's supposed to benefit buyers. Supposing, say, we have rent control, say, say you had an apartment that would, in a free market, would rent at $1,000 a month, but the rent control price is only $500. So it's supposed to be to the benefit of the renter because he's not going to have to pay $1,000, he's only going to have to pay $500. So those are the two kinds of price controls, the minimum and maximum prices. Now, as everybody should know by now, the price control won't work. It's not going to have the effect that the people who favor it say that they want. Let's imagine, for example, that there are maximum prices. So what's going to happen then? The marginal sellers, which are those who are making the least profit, will be driven out of business, and this will reduce supply. Let's take an example. Let's say I mentioned rent control. Supposing, say, you have, say, the rent on an apartment can't go above $500 a month. So then, supposing in the market it would go to $1,000, and now you say, $500. So there'll be some people won't make, if they were limited to $500, they're not going to be able to get any profit from that, because that amount won't cover repairs to the apartment and maintenance to the apartment. So they'll just leave the business. They'll say, look, I'm not going to offer my apartment for rent at that price. It's not worth it to me, so I'm just leaving the market. So the effect then will be, the price control will be to reduce supply. And here you see an example of what I meant when I said that if you try to violate the economic law is that there's a market clearing price. If you violate the economic law by setting a different price, this lower price, then, well, you say, why did you want to do that? Because you wanted to make housing available at a lower cost, but you're reducing the amount of housing that's available, so you're not really getting what you want. It's having a bad consequence from your own point of view. Now, some of the, as you will have gotten this, you remember this is, we covered this in previous lectures, and probably what I said so far came as no surprise, but one point Mises makes in the selection we have, he goes into a little more detail. Now, it turns out there are a couple cases that are exceptions where maximum prices don't reduce supply. Remember what I said so far is that the maximum price control will reduce supply because the people who are the marginal sellers, the ones who are making the least profit, will find it's no longer profitable for them to stay in business, and they'll just start withdrawing resources. So how could we get an exception to that? Well, supposing you're withdrawing resources from business, what's required if you're withdrawing the resource? Well, the resource has to be non-specialized. What I mean by that, it has alternative uses. Supposing, for example, I'm a blacksmith and I have an anvil. I don't know, maybe anvils are useful only in the blacksmith trade. If, say, the government started putting in price controls on, say, horseshoes, maybe the blacksmith wouldn't be able to shift the anvil to something else. So as long as he was making some money at all from it, he wouldn't shift it outward. If a resource is completely specialized, then it can't be shifted outward. Incidentally, since I mentioned blacksmith, does anybody know, sometimes you have an older word, a smithy, like in, remember Longfellow's famous poem, under the spreading chestnut tree, the village smithy stands. What does this, the word smithy, S-M-I-T-H-Y, mean? Can anybody tell me that? This is not a joke. It's a digression, but not a joke. Well, either the smith is a craftsman or a tradesman, but what I want to know is not smith, but smithy with a Y. Does anybody know that? Well, the smithy is the blacksmith shop. Some people think it's the blacksmith, but it isn't. It's the shop that he's working in. I just thought I'd mention it. So, okay, so supposing the resources are specialized. In my example, you have the anvil, can't be moved elsewhere. So then it won't be shifted out of the business unless the person just can't make any money at all and just abandoning the business. But it's only non-specialized resources that can be shifted out of a business. So suppose all of the specialized resources are used in producing a product in which price control is imposed, then so long as the people making the product are still making a profit, even though they'll be making less than before, they won't decrease the supply because they don't have anywhere else to go. So you see, here's a case where price control won't decrease supply. In the general case, it will, because the marginal sellers will move elsewhere. But in this case, there isn't, there's nowhere else for these resources to move. So it doesn't follow from that, from what I've said so far, is that if you have completely specialized resources that are all used in a particular industry, then the supply won't be shifted outward. But price control will still create a problem. It isn't that, okay, in this case, price control won't have any consequences that are undesirable from the point of view of those who favor price control. Because at the lower price, there'll still be more people who want to buy the product than suppliers are willing to supply. It's just that in cases with non-specialized resources, some of the suppliers will be leaving. So you'll have, in those cases, it'll be kind of a scissors effect. There'll be more, at the lower price, there'll be more demanders and fewer suppliers. So you'll get, that'll be two processes leading to a shortage. But here you'll just have one. In this case, the suppliers won't leave, but there'll be more demanders or suppliers. Now, Malcolm, do you have an example of that in history? Well, that I'd have to look into. Nothing coming to mind offhand. It doesn't sound like it would be too unlikely to happen. You just have to take a case where they're completely specialized resources. Now, Mises mentions another case in which price control might not decrease supply. Remember, the first one is we have completely specialized resources. Supposing a monopolist, remember, what is a monopolist? It's a single seller of product. He's charging a higher price than the competitive price. So we have someone selling a certain product. I'm the only one who, let's say I have the government gives me a monopoly on selling Mercedes cars. So if you want to buy a Mercedes, you have to come to me. And I'm charging a higher price than what would be the price, say, if people were free to enter the Mercedes business and compete with me. So I'm charging a higher price than that. So then, supposing the government imposes a price control, says, no, you can sell, you're the only one allowed to sell Mercedes, but you can't charge that much. You have to lower your price. So then it might turn out that even under the lower price, under the price control, I'm still making as much of a profit as what was available elsewhere, even under price control. So that's the second exception. The first one is completely specialized resources, and the other is this case of monopoly. And to anticipate the case Malcolm asked, is a historical example of that would be something like in utility companies. Sometimes the government will give a monopoly, say, to a particular company to produce electricity or supply water in a certain area, but it will also have regulations on what they can charge, so it will have both price control and monopoly. Now, when I'm talking about here monopoly, I mean a government-granted monopoly. a case where the government says to someone, look, you're the only one allowed to sell on this particular product. If we were talking about a free market, you can have a case where, say, there's a single seller of a product just arising on the free market. Let's say someone is a steel manufacturer. His way he produces steel is better than any of his competitors, and everybody buys that person's steel. So he doesn't have it. There aren't any other steel producers competing with that person. We would have a monopoly supplier, but we wouldn't really be able to show if the single seller had arisen on the free market that the person was charging a monopoly price. When we talk about monopoly prices here that are different from the competitive price, I have in mind the situation where there's a government-granted monopoly. And if you're interested in pursuing that question, you should look at Man, Economy, and State, Chapter 10 really in the free market, there isn't a way of distinguishing a competitive from a monopoly price. Now, as I said, this comes up in cases, say, where government gives monopoly to someone to supply electricity, then regulates price. And just as in the other case, even if suppliers don't leave the industry because of monopoly, because of the price control, because the monopolist is still doing as well as people in other industries, so he doesn't have the incentive to leave that he would have under regular price control. Still, price controls will lead to problems because of the shortages again. If the price is below the market clearing price, then there'll be more demand. There'll be more people demanding the product than is being supplied at that price. Now, what happens when price control results in a shortage? Well, you can see there's going to be a problem because at the below market price, there are more people who want to buy the product than can be supplied, that can be supplied with the product at that regulated price. There are more buyers than sellers. Then the question comes up, which buyers are going to get the product? And one common way to deal with this is rationing. Rationing would say, besides having the money to buy the good, you have to have a ration card or a ticket. So it isn't enough to have the money, you have to have the ticket also. So the reason for that is to try to prevent the situation where there are more people who want the good at the lower price and that there is available to supply them. They print the ration cards or tickets so that you don't get that sort of situation. So having enough money isn't enough to get you to the product. I see Helen says, are housing vouchers similar to rent control? No, not really. What a voucher is just giving you some money in order to buy something. So you have a housing voucher, you could use that to pay your rent or part of your rent. Rent control is changing limiting the price of the apartment, but the housing voucher would be giving you money to pay the rent. So that would be a different thing. You see what the difference is. It's just supposing, well, being an example, like supposing, say there's a, some of them don't vouchers indirectly raise the price. The other, that voucher is destined for. Well, they could in certain cases do that if they increase the quantity demanded, they could increase the price. It wouldn't have to have that effect. It would just depend on the particular situation. The example would be, supposing, say, my course is offered for a certain price, which is a free market price. It's like, here's the price we're going to take my course. You need this amount of money. You say, I wouldn't pay that, but maybe you would. So you're paying that. That's the amount of money you have to pay. Now, suppose somebody else says to you, I think you benefit from taking this course. So I'm going to give you the money to pay that, to take the course. You see, that wouldn't be the same as somebody saying, look, because you can't afford the course, we're going to limit the price of the course to something you can afford. This is just giving you a subsidy, so it's different. Now, I think Malcolm is right. In some cases, that could have an indirect effect on the price. It wouldn't have to, though, but it's still different. I say one way of dealing with this shortage is through rationing. And now, another solution is to increase the supply. Now, Helen said, should government guaranteed loans increase demand and cause price? Yes, that very often happens that way. Yes, that's quite true. Okay, so as I say, another thing that can happen in deal with shortages is to try to prevent or make it help out the suppliers who have to supply the good at the lower price by lowering their costs. So they'll say, well, if they can lower their cost, then they'll be willing to supply more even at the price control regulated price. So the price is lower, but if you can lower their costs, then they'll be willing to supply more. Now, as we already know from previous lectures, that's going to create more problems because what will happen? Well, if you limit the cost, then that's just imposing new price controls, and that'll generate further shortages. So if you say, well, okay, we're going to limit the price of cars, but then we're going to help out the car sellers by limiting the cost that they have to pay, that'll create further shortages. Then if you try to solve the new problems by adding even more controls, that will soon lead to total government control of the economy. You'll just have a system of total price controls. And this is what Mises calls socialism on the German pattern, because Germany put it into effect in World War I. It was called the Hindenburg Plan. And then also the Nazis starting in 1933, really fully in 1936, put that into effect in Germany, where you had, even though there were ostensibly private property, the government was saying what all the prices and wages should be, so it's really a form of socialism. Now, one thing that can happen also, if you have the problems with price control, like there are shortages, is people can just ignore the government regulations. Say, well, suppose you have the rent is limited to $500 a month and people can't get apartments at that price, or a lot of people want apartments, they're not available. They can offer the landlord extra money. So you could have an illegal market and sell it higher than regulation prices. So to some extent you can get around the price control. You can really get the market going again. In fact, that's been very important in the communist countries. You have very extensive black markets. But if you have a black market, it also causes problems. One thing is, it's hard to have a black market in products that require a lot of capital goods because it's much easier for the government to keep track of what those businesses are charging if you have a lot of capital goods. So more black markets tend to lead to a less capital intensive economy. Of course, it's the growth of capital goods that really gets the economy growing. So this is it wouldn't be the case if you say, well, price controls aren't really important because people can always evade them through the black market. That'll have some cost if they do so. And Hazlitt, in the selection we had, raised another point, which I thought was an interesting one, that I don't know whether maybe we could discuss whether he's right about it. He says that if you have a black market, then this will lead to people disregarding or not showing respect for the legal system, and he thinks that's a very bad idea. And then some people might wonder, is he right about that? So I think that would be an interesting point to discuss. So I think we'll stop here and get into the discussion. So I think Helen says, not if the legal system is self-serving to the government at expense of the people. Well, that's a very good point you raise. So you say, well, okay, it's all right to disobey the law if the government is really not serving the people. Now, supposing you're right about that, but then couldn't Hazlitt say, okay, but it's even better if we have a legal system that's a good legal system, then state affairs where people respect the good legal system is better than the one in which people ignore the legal system that's against their interests, even if that state affairs, namely where they ignore the bad legal system, is better than the one where they respect the bad one. If he would then have, I think Hazlitt would say then, possibly, or I don't know whether it hasn't for longer, you could say, well, maybe say, best thing is if people respect the good legal system. Then if you have a bad legal system, it's better if people don't follow it than if they do, at least in certain cases. But maybe people have other views on that. Now, Malcolm says, doesn't Rothbard also make the point of black market reducing regard for existing law? Yes, I'm sure he does. Now, Leslie says, is there less violence in societies with thriving black markets? You mean less than ones where you have price control without the black market? That I don't know. I mean, I suspect it would be hard to find societies that have price control without black markets. So it would be hard to answer that. Now Malcolm said, what would Mises and or you say, when would you, Mises or you say the discovery occurred that economic matters are also governed by law? Who discovered this? Who made the discovery of major degradation in the intellectual history of the study of economics, perhaps social science? Yes, it's certainly a major discovery. That was what Mises was saying. Now, Mises, I think, tended to put this discovery later than Rothbard did. I think Mises thought it was primarily, say, in the 17th or 18th century. But Rothbard, you know, if you look at his history of economic thought, has it more of a really there were some precursors of economic law in the ancient world, but it was really more of a medieval idea. So Rothbard put it earlier than Mises, but it certainly is very important development in intellectual history. That was what I was trying to get at in the first part of the lecture. Now, Arthur says, how does this discussion bear upon or relate to black markets and prohibited goods such as liquor during prohibition or marijuana now? That's a very good question. You see, you could take that, what you could say is, if you have a prohibited good, that could be taken as an extreme form of price control. You would take it as, you could say that would be one that would be setting an infinite price for the good. You could take a prohibited good as an example of infinite price control with an infinite price, so no one would be able to pay it. So the analysis would apply, that I gave would apply exactly to these as well. Now, Helen says, wasn't the American Revolution or rebellion against the legal system that exploited them? Yes, that was certainly, there were a lot of economic grievances in the American Revolution, like under the Navigation Acts and so on. It was also, I mean, in part, there was some movement for political control, but you're right, economic things were, economic regulation was certainly very important. Now, Malcolm here says, you wrote in Lecture 1, meeting any pattern of argument, taking the opponent's position, playing that position out logically, looking at all ramifications, consequences, and this was significant political philosophy and economics. No. I'm sorry. I didn't say that Mises invented that pattern. It was just one that he used a great deal in order, what he was trying to do there by showing the consequences was to be able to come up with a value-free way of showing problems with certain kinds of interventions. So if, say, as we did in the lecture today, we say, look, price control leads to shortages, that doesn't involve a value judgment. It isn't saying, well, I don't like price control or I don't like shortages, so then somebody else could say, okay, you don't like them, but I'm willing to put up with them. It's just saying this is what the consequence is. So Mises didn't invent that, but he used that pattern of argument a lot. Then you go on to say, in your introductory logic course, did you cover ways of crafting arguments? Well, some of them, I think. Would you teach a course in all the different ways of crafting arguments? I don't know all of what I was dealing with. The course is just sort of principally how we check whether arguments are valid. That's, say, whether the conclusions follow from the premises. Do you think that would be a good supplemental course to your introduction to logic? Well, it might be. I mean, it's an interesting idea. Why not? This is just made an independent study course by Mises. Well, I mean, it might be. It sounds like an interesting idea. I don't know whether I have enough craft for that. I suppose I'm a rather crafty person, but I don't know whether I have the requisite craft. But it's a good suggestion. Jeff says, why are price controls so popular when they never work? Well, I think it's that's a very good question. It's a kind of a natural way for people to think that they'll think, Leslie said, I'll have to work in the craft yard. Well, I'll go to ask the blacksmith as soon as I get out of the smithy. Okay. It's a natural way. Suppose we'd say prices are too high. I can't pay for something that I want. I think, well, wouldn't it be nice if prices were lower? So why not have a government pass a law about it? And one of the things we were talking about, you know, the broken window fallacy is people don't take account of, very often don't take account of long-run consequences or indirect consequences of what they want. They'll just say, okay, the price is too high, so why don't we just pass a law to lower it? Now, you're quite right. If they looked at history, we'd see all sorts of examples. They don't work, but people aren't willing to do that. We see this in tariffs also. People always say, oh, well, look, the tariff will just drive people out of jobs in this country. If we don't have free trade, we'll drive people out of jobs, so we have to have tariffs. And then economists have been pointing out hundreds of years ago, but look, if you have free trade, that will increase employment elsewhere. and people don't take that into account. Yes, in order to pop politicians get elected, they advocated price controls. Yes, that's a very good point. Now, Danny said, Hopper writes that price controls are a form of conservative socialism, attempt to freeze the demand side of a particular market in order to preserve a past structure of production. Ah, that's interesting. Yes, I think that sounds like it's quite plausible. That's a very good. Oh, Danny is Ryan this time around. Meet is in students. Oh, well, as long as you still have the Gmail address on email. Where did Robert or others write about the connection between Roundheads and later Pietist Yankees in the U.S.? If so, where would you recommend reading? Well, Robert wrote about post-millennial Pietism in the U.S. in the 19th century, and we followed an economic historian named Kleppner on that point. I think you're thinking, though, with Roundheads, there was a book by Carl Oglesby, I think, who had something discussed certain people in the U.S. using that term, I think, but I think he was the one probably you have in mind there. So I don't think, but I think you, the thing to look at there from Rothbard, where he talked about post-millennial Pietism, what would be good on that? I know he has some articles on that, but I think if you look in Journal Libertarian Studies, I think he has some stuff on post-millennial Pietism. Just look up Rothbard and Kleppner, Kleppner. You'll just see his discussion of the Kleppner thesis. I think would be good on that. Mao says, well, William H. Hutt, British economist, came up with the phrase consumer salary. Was he the first one to come up with the concept that consumers really wanted in charge of capitalism or any free trade system in 1936 and was both economists and the public? Well, you find that that's actually a very popular idea. I mean, Mises has this notion. It's one of the basic themes that Mises had, I mean, in his early writings. But I think the notion that's really the consumers who are running the economic system was one that you found in economists in the 19th century. I think you find even in John Stuart Mill has this. All sorts of people had that. So it isn't something that had originated. Now here's one, Matthew. Do most contemporary schools of economics accept the economic laws you present as view specific to the Austrian school? No, I think this would be pretty common to most economic schools. If say you went to a university, just took a standard course in microeconomics that not from an Austrian school economist, you'd be getting a lot of the price control material be quite similar to what I gave. Maybe there'd be some differences, like Austrians would tend to stress that there aren't exceptions so much, or that, but what I was giving is pretty standard analysis. We'll be seeing in one of the later lectures when we talk about Austrian monetary theory, there are distinctive Austrian ideas on monetary theory that different from those of other economic schools, but on price control would not be as common, or free trade, that would be very common to practically all economists today. That was one point, actually. Mises was very keen to stress that he didn't call himself so much an Austrian economist. He thought he was really the economist. There was this scientific law that laws that have been established, just say a physicist today wouldn't say, I'm an Einsteinian, meaning I'm a follower of Einstein as opposed to other physicists. We would take the common body of accepted theory. Mises thought the same way about economics. It's not just that people in his school hold certain things and other people hold other things. Now, in certain areas, that isn't the case. There isn't so much of a consensus, but price control is one where there is. Now, Malcolm said, in previous lectures, someone wrote a suggestion you didn't get, as it was addressed to all attendees versus all participants. Suggest was that teaching a course on Say's Law and all its ramifications. I recommend a course on the Common Economic Laws theory and misinterpreting the ramifications. Well, that's an interesting idea. Maybe we could call that course Say What? Yes, that's a good idea. Well, one thing we should figure out, you know, of course, next week we'll have the lecture at regular time, but the week after that, I'll be at the Mises Institute for Mises U, so we have to figure out whether I'll be giving the last lecture at Mises U or the week after that when I get back home. So I think that would be one thing the administrator should think about. Okay, I mean, I'd be very happy to do it at the Institute. Yeah, I mean, I could. I have my slides are all set to go. Unusually for me, I have all the slides ready this time. Now I have to worry about getting my lectures for the Mises Institute, Mises University course. I have to give the introductory praxeology lecture because Hans Hoppe usually gives that, but he's not coming this year. Yes, well, whatever people want is fine with me. Now, Cam says, Cam, your answer reminded me of a story. Everything reminded me of a story when Bob Hope was dying. You know, I think Hope was around 100 years old. And when he was dying, his wife said to him, which cemetery would you like to be buried in? And he answered, surprise me. Arthur said, tell us more about your praxeology course. Well, this is just an introductory lecture, and I'm just going to go into some of the basics on deductive reasoning and a priori reasoning all that time. Malcolm, would you say any type, I think you mean type of boxes will cause some form of distortion in the economic system, either great demand for an item, higher price, or less efficient use of that item? Well, it will have a redistributional effect. It's just shifting. If you give people money, you're taking away money from other people and giving it to them. So it'll have some effects. The effect would basically be one of redistribution. It might have some effect in limiting, in certain cases, it could limit the security of property rights, but it wouldn't have, restrict redistribution effects wouldn't have to, don't operate in the same way as price controls. As I say, it's just like giving you giving somebody more money just to be able to buy things, but that wouldn't really change the way prices were formed. Oh, I see, I've given, but, I think I'll be making it a little different this year. You know, I have slides I could use for my last lecture, but maybe I'll put in a few changes this time. I think I gave it last year because Hans didn't come last year either. But it's not a performative contradiction if he does come. Now, is he stuck? No, I think he wasn't stuck in the airport. He just, I think he has things to do. He lives in Turkey now, and he can't always get away. I think he had something to do in one of the years with some family business, some land in Austria. Something came up. I'm not sure what the circumstances were, but I mean, if he wanted to come, I'm sure. I mean, if we were able to come, I'm sure he'd have no trouble. It'd be nice to see him. He usually comes every year either to Mises U or the what used to be called the Scholars Conference. Now it's the Austrian Conference on Economic Research. But this year, he usually comes to one of the two, but not both. So we saw, I think we saw him this year. Yeah, I think we did. No, I go to so many conferences, they all blend into each other. But it would be nice. It's always nice to see Hans. Now, Malcolm said, I was speaking to a very well-known professor of economic history recently. I asked him for his opinion on Rothbard. He said, he's dangerous. Oh, well, that's interesting. Very well-known professor of economic history. Let me guess. Was it Deirdre McCloskey? I think they would think, I mean, he does has different views from the ones that are popular that they use. I mean, one thing, say, he's opposed to certain, in economic history, he's opposed to certain kinds of quantitative analysis that they use. He wrote very negative reviews, say, of Douglas North or Richard Fogel. So he doesn't like the way a lot of them use economic history. Someone who's held high postings in academic field and trade organization in economic history. Ah, that's interesting. And did he say why he thought Rothbard was dangerous? Oh, the ideas were all wrong. It's cultish. Well, I mean, if you're going to call those objections, all right. Oh, I see. Well, I mean, Charles said, did Malcolm, I couldn't very well refute if I don't even know who he is. Yes, you're not trying to, but yes, I think well-placed kick it to an appropriate part of the anatomy is in order in such cases. You have to get their attention. This little, I'm in trouble because I didn't answer. Now, since I believe letting people who are incorrect, we're sent their ways to let the market environment prove it wrong. Only one way, when we're reality is a great teacher. I guess that's a good way, good understanding. Well, I think you have a very good point, Michael. And even if I disagreed with you, I would just let the market environment prove you wrong rather than trying to argue against you. Okay, I guess we're out of time now, so I hope I'll see you all next week. Thanks a lot. Thanks, everybody.